So it looks like we're up to slide six. And what we're seeing here in these generic Punnett squares, this isn't any particular example. This represents any example of a cross involving, of crosses involving a genetically heritable disorder. And specifically one that's caused by a recessive allele. So first of all, not all genetic disorders are heritable, right? Like cancer, I gave you as an example of a genetic disorder because it involves genes, it involves DNA. It's damage to the DNA is what causes cancer. That's not a heritable genetic disorder, though. You don't inherit from your parents. A heritable genetic disorder is caused by particular alleles that you get from your parents. You inherit the disorder. And this one is, whatever ones these represent generically, they are caused by a recessive allele. And specifically, as you would expect, for recessivity, you don't actually have the trait unless you are homozygous recessive, right? So only a homozygous recessive individual will be affected by the disorder, whatever it is. And that explains the color coding here. Oh, another thing that's true of these, even more specifically, is that this happens to be a sex-linked recessive genetically heritable disorder. So it's on the X chromosome. There's other possibilities for genetic disorders on autosomes, but this one's a sex chromosome, sex-linked one. So the color coding here, any individual box is either white, light red, or darker red. The white represents a completely normal individual. Not only does that individual not have the disorder, but also doesn't even have any is not carrying any alleles that can cause it in offspring. Light red is a carrier. A carrier of the disorder has one allele that can lead to the disorder, but one normal allele, and that normal allele, because of dominance, keeps the individual from having the disorder, so they don't have it themselves. But because they have the mutant allele, they can pass that on to their offspring if they reproduce. And darker red means an affected individual. That individual actually has the disorder. And these aren't all the possible ways that you can have matings, but this is just a sampling to show you how it affects the possibilities in the offspring if they do reproduce. So if you have a completely normal mother or female and an affected male and they mate, then the Punnett square says that all of the daughters, because the XXs are the daughters, right, will be carriers. None of them will actually have it, but they'll be able to be, depending on whom their daughters mate with, they might be able to have children that are affected. All the males, on the other hand, are going to be completely normal, and that's because to be a male, you have to be XY, and you have to get your Y from the father, the only parent that has a Y. And therefore, you get your X from the mother, and she was completely normal. So all the males will be normal in that case, in that cross. In the middle one, we have a carrier female and a completely normal male. In this case, still no daughter has the disease, but half of them will be carriers and half of them will be totally normal. Half of the males will be totally normal, and half of the sons will actually have it. And then the most of these three, which aren't all of the possibilities, the most dangerous one with respect to having a child with the disorder would be a carrier female and an affected male. Half of the daughters are going to have it, half of them will be carriers, half of the males will have it. The only possibility of completely normal would be 50% of the sons. And of course, it would be even worse if you had an affected female crossed with an affected male. Yeah.
for the one in the middle, why is it that the male is a carrier? And you said that males usually aren't affected.
Did I say carrier? I should have said affected. This male is affected. This one's completely normal. Yeah, males can't be carriers if you use the word carrier to mean don't have it yourself. Because they only have one allele, right? Since they only have one X chromosome. So they are either affected because they have the mutant allele, or they're completely normal because they have the dominant allele. Okay, now on to 7. We're using a cat example here, but it applies to other mammals like humans as well, even though it's for different characteristics. We don't have fur like this. But fur color is the characteristic here. And this is a sex-linked trait, or a sex-linked characteristic in cats. The gene is on the X chromosome. And we've already talked about how sex determination works in us. Well, it's the same in cats, XY system. Which means that for a sex-linked characteristic, for a sex-linked gene, there is a difference in so-called dosage between the two sexes. Dosage is a word used in this context to refer to how many alleles for that gene an individual has. Well, for an autosomal situation, a gene that's on an autosome, the dosage is equal between the sexes, right? They both have two alleles. But for a sex-linked characteristic, the female having two X chromosomes will have a double dosage compared to a male. And sometimes that just exists and nothing is done about it, but for depending on species, there can be what is called dosage compensation, which is a way to try to make up for this difference in number of alleles between the two sexes. Well, you could accomplish this if you were just designing things in either of two ways. Males have one dose, females have a double dose. So you could accomplish it two ways, making them equal. You could bring the male up to the level of the female. That's one way. Well, you don't do that by doubling the amount of DNA. That's determined how much DNA that the male has. But one way that you could bring the male up to the level of the female is to transcribe that one gene that's on that one X chromosome that a male has twice as easily, twice as often as the two alleles that are on the two X chromosomes of a female get transcribed. So they're working with different amounts of DNA, but you end up making the same amount of protein if you do it that way. Do you see what I'm saying here? That's one way, and certain species do that. That's not what's happening here, though. The other fundamental way you could solve the inequity is to bring the female down to the level of the male. And that is done here in cats through a process called X chromosome inactivation, which does exactly what the phrase says it does. One of the two X chromosomes in a female is inactivated. How this is accomplished is by condensing the chromatin. We've talked about the condensing of chromatin that happens for all chromosomes in the context of the cell cycle, right? The chromatin is usually loose and usable. The genes can be read until it gets ready to divide, and that's when it condenses into individual chromosomes that you can see, but it's temporarily unusable in that form. And then it gets loose again in the next cell so that it can be used, and so on. Well, for X chromosome inactivation, one of the two X chromosomes in a female gets randomly chosen and gets highly condensed and permanently for the lifetime of that individual. Meaning that X chromosome is there, but it's never going to be able to be used as genes. So that's effectively bringing her down to the level of the male. She has just one allele, even though she has two chromosomes, one usable allele for any gene that's on there, just like the male does. Now, the interesting thing that is illustrated by the picture here is that this does not happen at the zygote stage. Well, before I even get to that, let me say that if a female is homozygous for whatever it is, in this case it's fur color, if she's homozygous, then it doesn't matter which of the two X chromosomes gets inactivated randomly, right? Because she has two of the same allele. So she could be homozygous orange or homozygous black. Either way, turning one of them off, you're going to get the same color no matter which one you choose. You would be fully orange colored or fully black colored. But for a heterozygous female, it does matter which one gets turned off, right? Because that's going to determine which one gets left on, which is going to be the allele that's used. And so it's just like a homozygous male in that case. Dominance and recessivity doesn't matter. There's only one allele. Whichever one you get, that's the trait you have. Well, now back to what I was saying about the fact that this does not occur at the zygote stage. But if it did, what's special about the zygote is that it's one cell, right? So if one of the two X chromosomes in that one-celled zygote that this cat began as gets inactivated, and she's a heterozygous individual, as you see here, then whichever one is not inactivated is going to determine the color, and it will be a fully that color, either all black or all orange. It doesn't happen that early, though. The X chromosome inactivation doesn't occur until the embryonic stage, where it's already a mass of many cells. And then when it does happen, it happens randomly in each of the cells. Each cell flips a coin to determine which of the two X chromosomes gets inactivated in that cell. And then it becomes permanent not only for that cell, but for all the cells that it splits into. So you have an embryo that's basically a mass of cells, more or less a sphere early on. But the position of the cell in that mass is actually going to correspond to the position in the body of the cat once it develops. And since each of them is randomly going to be either orange-furred or black-furred, that means in the adult cat, there's going to be places that are orange right next to places that are black. It's going to be speckled, basically, because of that randomness. Okay. And therefore, we call her a mosaic, because it's like a patchwork, or a non-patterned patchwork of two traits. Same thing can happen with female humans, but not with fur color. So it's not something that you could just look at a female to notice, but it happens, for instance, with the ability to freely sweat. So a heterozygous female, because of X chromosome inactivation, will have patches of her skin that are easily able to sweat and other patches right next to it that can't. It's not something you notice, but if you did pore by pore examination, you could do it. Oh, by the way, this X chromosome inactivation is just one of many examples of an epigenetic change. There is a branch of biology called epigenetics. Epigenetic, as a word, means above the level of the gene, above the DNA level. But what it really refers to, an epigenetic change, is a change in DNA, and therefore the expression of the DNA, without actually changing the sequence of the DNA. Now, you've already learned from all this stuff we've been talking about that if you change the sequence of the DNA, like that's what a mutation is, obviously that's going to affect the expression. But in epigenetic change, the DNA is still the correct sequence. Something else happens to it. X chromosome inactivation is just one example of that. And it accomplishes dosage compensation. All right, now to eight. Back to flies. Notice what the P generation is here. Starts out as a dihybrid cross because there are two characteristics here, right? Body color and wing shape. Body color has two traits. Can be either the wild type, which is also dominant, the gray body color, or black, the mutant form. Wing shape can be either a full normal wing, which is the wild type, or a vestigial wing, which is much reduced in size, as you see. Well, here again, we're using this standard of using the initials not of the dominant trait for the genotypes, but for the recessive. So B stands for black, which is recessive, but B with a plus superscript really means the wild type, which is gray. B plus is gray, VG plus is normal wings, B is black, VG is vestigial wing. All right, so we have two doubly homozygous parents. A doubly homozygous dominant crossed with a doubly homozygous recessive. Nothing new about that, just except that the example's different. We're using flies. Those are crossed and produce, of course, the F1, which is represented by just this gray one in the second row. All of the F1s, of course, will look like this, right? Because of dominance. They are showing the sexes here, but that's not because this is sex-linked. It has nothing to do with that. She just happens to be a female from the F1. And here's where it's a little bit different. As we've been talking about it, normally you would cross F1 with another F1 to produce an F2. Here we're doing a different kind of test cross. So we're taking an F1, which is a doubly heterozygous individual, right? B plus B, VG plus VG. But because of dominance, it's doubly dominant in phenotype, crossing that with a doubly homozygous recessive individual. Well, the recessive individual, this black vestigial winged individual that's being crossed, that the F1's being crossed with, because it's homozygous for both, can only make one kind of sperm when all you care about are these two characteristics, right? Sperm has to have a B and a BG. That's why there's only one row in this Punnett square. But the F1 individual can produce, and it happens to be a female, can produce four gametes, eggs, right? B plus BG plus B plus VG, B VG plus, or B VG. Meiosis randomly chooses one from each. Okay, so that's where you get the Punnett square. Now, these first two are categorized as what? How would you categorize these first two, the left two that are in the Punnett square? Yes, they are parental types. They're not homozygous because look at their genotypes. This one is, but not this one. They are parental types because each of these is like one parent or the other for both of the traits, for both of the characteristics. These two aren't like either parent, right? Each one has one parent's trait for one of the characteristics and the other parent's trait for the other characteristic. So these are called recombinant types, correct? All right, now, the real point of doing this is to test predictions that come from hypotheses. Remember the scientific method. A hypothesis is an explanation, and predictions come logically from hypotheses, and those are what you test, are predictions. So you have two competing hypotheses here, specifically that the genes involved, these two, the color gene and the wing shape gene, are on different chromosomes. The other is that they are on the same chromosome. One of those is true, right? There's no other possibilities. They are either both on the same chromosome or they're on separate chromosomes. But these two hypotheses have different predictions associated with them. If the two genes are on different chromosomes, then you would expect all four of these possibilities because they're like passengers on different ships, right? The ships can go different directions. They can separate from each other, or the ships can go in the same direction. They can be with each other. And therefore, all four possibilities exist. Moreover, all four of them are equally possible because there's just as much chance as each of them. Therefore, for this hypothesis that the genes are on different chromosomes, the expected ratio of these four would be 1 to 1 to 1 to 1, 25% of each of them. If they're on the same chromosome, though, the two genes, remember that genes don't move around in isolation. They are passengers on chromosomes. So if they are on the same chromosome, wherever the chromosome goes, both of those alleles go at the same time. One for color, one for wing shape. And therefore, you shouldn't see all four of these possibilities. You would only see parental types if they were on the same chromosome. That's why the predicted ratio is 1 to 1 to 0 to 0. Zero is indicating the impossibility of recombinance. Are those predictions clear? You see where those came from? All right, well, look at the actual results. These real numbers on the bottom are the real results when they did this. And neither of the two predictions came true, even though they correspond to the only two possibilities. They're either on the same chromosome or they're not, right? One of them is true. The real results are, though, about 1,000, about 1,000, about 200, about 200. Not close to 1 to 1 to 1 to 1, and certainly not 1 to 1 to 0 to 0. Now, the fact that it's not... This is a pretty big sample size. This isn't doing them for just four individuals. This is multiple thousands. And the bigger the sample size, the closer you should get to the real ratio, to the predicted ratio. This is a big enough sample size that these should be almost equal if this first hypothesis is true. The fact that you have so many fewer recombinant types compared to parentals suggests that the second one is true, but how can it be positive instead of zero? What's happening here is that you have all four possibilities, which means alleles are on the same chromosome. That's why it's not close to 1 to 1 to 1 to 1. Okay? But despite being on the same chromosome, sometimes they get separated. How is that possible based on what you've learned?
Crossing
over. Exactly. Crossing over can separate two alleles even if they're on the same chromosome, right? Because that's a swapping that occurs. They're together at first, but if the chiasma forms in the right place and they go to separate cells, they're no longer together. Yeah.
So in other words, the second prediction is correct. It's just some crossover occurred that's causing the other.
Exactly. And that's why the hypothesis as written is actually disconfirmed. I didn't read the whole hypothesis. I just said either
second line.
And parental alleles are always inherited together. That's what's actually false. And that's because of crossing over violates that.
Yeah.
So this, remember we talked about sex-linked as a phrase last time? Well, that's one important thing. Here we're talking about linkedness. So just linked by itself. I don't want you to confuse this with sex-linked. These are two totally different things. First, just to refresh your memory, sexed link simply means occurring on a sex chromosome. That's all it means. And any gene individually is either sex-linked or not. It makes sense, in other words, to talk about a single gene being sex-linked. The word linked does not make sense if you're talking about a single gene, and it has nothing to do with the sex chromosome. Linked refers to a pair of genes. We're tracking two genes here, right, corresponding to the two characteristics. Two genes are linked if they are on the same chromosome, regardless of what kind of chromosome it is. If they're not, if one of them's on the number 4 and one of them's on the number 13, then they're not linked. They're riding in different boats. Okay? That's all those mean. That's a fundamental difference. That has nothing to do with sex-linked. So that's what we're looking at here. Two linked genes, and therefore the traits are linked. And in the next slide of 9, we can look at what's happening at the chromosomal level in case you haven't pictured it already from what we've been saying. So this is the F1 individual. We're not looking at the parental here. This is the F1. Notice that when you look at the chromosomes, you can see that it's a double heterozygote, right? As all the F1s were. And one of these black marks is the color gene. The other one is the wing shape gene. This is the test cross individual, the doubly homozygous recessive. Okay, well, when meiosis in this F1 occurs, that can involve crossing over, right? And crossing over randomly happens, meaning that the chiasma, the point of crossover between the two non-sister chromatids, can be anywhere along the length of the chromosome. Well, if it's anywhere except between the two gene loci here, then they're going to stay together. Even it's going to be just like crossing over didn't happen from their point of view, right? But any chiasma that forms between one gene and the other, that's going to separate them because of the swap that takes place. And so B plus and VG plus were together originally, but if chiasma forms between them, the B plus is going to go to one cell, one gamete, and the VG plus is going to go to the other one. That's how you can have recombinant types, even though they're linked genes. Well, decades ago, a grad student in a genetics lab figured out mathematically that, or it occurred to him that, you can actually use the probability of this crossing over happening in the right place, namely between the two linked gene loci, to figure out how close they are to each other. Now, this is back in the days when we couldn't look at DNA. We could make the crosses and look at the offspring phenotypically. We just couldn't get in there and look at the DNA. So what he realized is that if you have results like this, like these results, and these are the same results we just looked at, where you have a certain number of parentals, but a much lower amount of recombinants, that's an indication that they are linked, because if they weren't linked, you'd have the same frequency of all four possibilities. It's an indication that they're linked, but you can also tell how linked they are, meaning how close together they are. The closer together they are, the less likely it is for a randomly occurring chiasma to form between them, right? There's much less space between them. And that would correspond in the observable offspring to a smaller fraction of the total offspring being recombinant. So he devised what's called the recombination frequency, which is simply the total number of recombinants, this plus this, 206 plus 185, divided by the total number of offspring, all four of them, and then multiplied by 100 just to make it a percentage. The lower that is, the more closely together they are. That information by itself is valuable, and back in these days when we couldn't just look at the DNA. It's part of gene mapping. So first, you know, when you do all kinds of crosses, working with all kinds of genes, you finally get a picture of which genes are on the same chromosome with each other, which genes are on other chromosomes. That's part of mapping. Then once you've done a bunch of work to figure out, you have a collection of genes that you know must be on the same chromosome, a fundamental question that comes after that is, where are they on that chromosome compared to each other? And that's what this can be helpful for. You can see that in 10. This just involves three different crosses, one of which we just looked at. Each cross involves two characteristics, a dihybrid cross. So the one we just looked at was for body color, which is the B allele here is for body color. That's the body color gene. And wing shape, that's the VG gene. And as the previous slide showed you, that had a recombination frequency of 17%. Then they did the same thing, but with two different genes, body color and eye color, which is what the CN is an example of. That had a 9%. And then eye color and wing shape in a separate dihybrid cross. That's three crosses to figure this out. That had 9.5%. Which, notice, those add up to almost exactly 17%. So that told him, well, because the recombination between these two genes is so much more frequent, that must mean that they're farther apart and this one's in the middle. That's gene mapping without ever actually looking at any DNA. So in a sense, it's kind of an old-fashioned thing now because we can just look at DNA sequencing, but this is how we figured it out originally. Just mathematically. And 11 is really more of the same, just using even more genes that are on that same chromosome. The numbers that you see here, 0 is just arbitrarily assigned to one that is farthest toward the end. And then all the other numbers are just in relation to that 0. They're not real units or anything. They're just, but they all come from recombination frequencies. A slide that has to do with an error that it can occur during meiosis. Remember, meiosis has two division events, meiosis 1 and meiosis 2, and the error can occur in either of these, or both for that matter. But before I get to the error, let's talk about what happens normally in meiosis. Normally things go off without an error. But, of course, what happens, as we've talked about in anaphase, is separation. Depending on meiosis 1 or 2, it's different things that separate. But it's separation that occurs in anaphase. Well, another word for separate is disjoin, and the noun form of that is just disjunction. So disjunction is normal. That's what should happen in meiosis. Disjunction in meiosis 1 would be the two homologs separating from each other. Disjunction in meiosis 2 would be the two chromatids separating from each other. All right? Well, that doesn't always happen, though. It's supposed to disjoin whatever it is. Sometimes it doesn't. And therefore, the error is called non-disjunction. The failure to disjoin or separate. And that's what I said can occur in either meiosis 1 or meiosis 2. So I need to give you another definition. We've talked quite a bit about ploidy, right? I gave you the word ploidy, which is a general word. But we talked about two degrees of ploidy, haploidy and diploidy. Those are all words you should know by now. But there is a separate word called euploidy. And what does the EU indicate as a prefix? True or good, exactly. Just like in eukaryote. Well, euploidy refers to the condition in which the cell, whatever it is, has the correct or normal number of chromosomes for that cell type and for that species. So if it's a haploid cell, it'll have N chromosomes. If it's a diploid cell, it will have 2N, which is normal in both of those cases, right? If it has any other number, then we use AN in front of that to make it not. Aneuploidy is the condition of abnormal number of chromosomes. And the adjective would be aneuploid, an aneuploid cell. I wanted to give you that definition because non-disjunction in meiosis leads to aneuploidy. If something doesn't disjoin, that means one of the two daughter cells is going to get too much and the other one's not going to get enough. Both of those are aneuploid conditions. Right? They're both an abnormal number of chromosomes, but in different ways. On the left, we have non-disjunction of the tetrad occurring, just one of the two tetrads. This one's going to separate normally, but this one doesn't. And therefore, this daughter cell, instead of getting just one of the homologs, gets both of them. This one doesn't get either homolog for that bigger chromosome. Both of those are problematic. They're both aneuploid already, right? But you can be aneuploid by having too much DNA, having too many chromosomes, or by having too few chromosomes. Which would you guess is the more severe condition, the harder to survive?
Less.
Less, right. Because if you don't have a chromosome, you don't have any of the genes that are on that chromosome. There can be thousands of genes on a chromosome, which means you're not able to make any of the proteins that they code for. Very unlikely to survive that. But having too much is actually problematic too, depending on the chromosome. Some are more survivable than others. And in different groups of organisms, like plants survive it much better than animals, for instance. But anyway, if you have non-disjunction occurring in meiosis one, the two intermediate daughter cells are already aneuploid, and therefore even if everything happens normally in meiosis two, all four of the gametes will be aneuploid. Right? Some with too many, some with too few. On the right, though, we have meiosis one happening without a problem. And then in one of the two daughter cells, non-disjunction occurs in meiosis two. So that affects only these two gametes. These two are normal. We're back to the topic of mutation. Actually, non-disjunction is itself a mutation because it's a change in DNA. But in what slide 13 summarizes are categories of mutation, but at a much broader level than the categories we already studied. In that other chapter, when we first talked about mutations, those were point mutations, which affected either a single nucleotide or a very small number of them. So not even an entire gene, just a small piece of a gene. Here, we're talking about chromosomal mutations, not point mutations. And this affects large sections of a chromosome, and therefore many, many entire genes, not just a tiny piece of one gene. So the effects are much more pronounced in chromosomal mutations than in point mutations. So each of these is a cartoon chromosome. A, B, C, and D, and so on, those are not genes. They are just sections of the chromosome. All right. A itself contains many genes. B contains many genes, and so on. So don't think of them as being genes. But the first category is deletion. We had deletions for point mutations. That's removing just a single nucleotide. But in a chromosomal deletion, an entire section of the chromosome gets deleted. D gets cut out here in this example. So A, B, C, D, E turns into A, B, C, E. Therefore, any gene that's in D is lost, that can have a big effect, right? Missing genes, you're going to miss those proteins. Duplication is easier to survive, much easier to survive, because you're not removing any information, you're actually copying a section, in this case BC, and now you have two versions of it. You have A, B, C, B, C again, and then D, E, F. If we look at the DNA, our own DNA or other organisms' DNA, there's evidence of this happening a lot throughout history. It makes sense that it would be survivable, right? You still have all the genes in BC that were there originally. Now you have other copies of them. And these new copies are kind of like trials that you can mess around with evolutionarily, not have to worry that mutation can occur in them because you have the original ones still. So mutation can run wild, and every once in a while you'll get a better version without actually taking a chance, in a sense. That's why it's survivable. In inversion, which means to flip around or to turn upside down, is the same thing. The BCD section here gets left to right flipped. So A, BCDE becomes A, DCBE. There's no addition or subtraction of material here. It's an inversion. But that doesn't mean there's no effect. Two reasons why this can have actually a profound effect. One is that these cuts are made somewhere, right? The line between A and B is one cut. The line between D and E is another cut. Well, if those cuts happen to be right in the middle of a gene, then you're going to destroy those two genes, right? Or at least one of them on the one end. Because they're not going to be... The gene's going to start here, and then there's going to be a gap. It's going to end over here. It's no longer going to work as a gene, right? So it could destroy a couple genes, for one thing. That can be bad news. But also, even all of the genes that are in the middle here and are going to still be intact, just reversed, those might be affected because the genes, which are the minority of the DNA, are a set of instructions for how to build mRNA. But all of that, those long stretches of DNA between the genes, the non-coding stretches I was talking about, which is 99% of your DNA, some of that, we're still figuring out what it does, if anything, but some of it does is help to control whether genes get turned on appropriately or not. So if you have a gene in the wrong place now, all of a sudden, even though it's intact, it might not be expressed appropriately. You might not be able to turn it on, so you don't get that protein. You might not be able to turn it off, which is bad also. You'd be continuously making the protein when it's not appropriate to continuously make it. The most complicated of the four that we're looking at here is on the bottom, because it involves two separate chromosomes. That's reciprocal translocation. It involves a break of a section from one chromosome, a break of a section from another chromosome that end up being swapped. So that's the translocation, meaning movement from one chromosome to another. MNO came from another chromosome, but now it's on this chromosome. Same for AB. Kind of like crossing over, only accidentally. And once again, now that these, even the genes that are still intact are in a different place in the library, and therefore they might not be expressed the same way. There is a specific example shown in slide 14 of a reciprocal translocation that occurs fairly frequently in humans, involving chromosomes 9 and 22 that you see. That creates what's called the Philadelphia chromosome, which has part of 9 on it. It's not supposed to be there, and it has a missing part of 22. I forget what the incidence is, one in however many, but it happens. For chemical reasons, it can happen fairly easily. And this is one way of developing leukemia. It has shows you that there is phenotypic effects of messing around with the positions of these genes. 15. 15, we're looking at another example of an epigenetic change. X chromosome inactivation was epigenetic. Well, there's all kinds of examples of epigenetic changes. I'm just going to give you one more, though, with this final slide, which is an example called genetic imprinting, or actually genomic imprinting, or more simply, imprinting. But anyway, what happens here is that if a gene is imprinted, and not all are, but we're finding more and more. We used to think it was really rare, and we're actually finding quite a few genes are imprinted. But what that means is that in any given organism, which is a diploid organism, like this rodent, it has two alleles, of course, right? Being a diploid, has two alleles for the gene. But an imprinted gene means that one of the two alleles will be turned off for the lifetime of that individual. Kind of like what happens with X chromosome inactivation, except for a single gene. And it involves modification of histones, basically makes that gene unreadable for the whole lifetime of that organism. But more than that, it's not random like X chromosome inactivation is. For imprinting, it's the allele that gets inactivated is one that comes, and it's on a gene by gene basis, but it depends on what the parent, which parent gave you that allele. So some genes are imprinted by the father, other genes are imprinted by the mother. In this case, it's the mother's allele that gets inactivated in the offspring. And the father's allele, whatever that is the one that shines through and therefore determines the trait. The example here, the example trait, is a gene. I mean, the example characteristic is a body size characteristic that's affected by a gene that's imprinted. At the top, you have a homozygous individual. So both of the alleles here are normal, but one of them is going to get imprinted. It's one of them is going to get silenced for the lifetime of that. He's homozygous, though, or this male, whatever sex it is homozygous, so it doesn't matter which one gets turned off, right? He's going to be normal-sized. But remember, I shouldn't say it doesn't matter, because unlike the randomness of X chromosome inactivation, it's going to be his mother's version that gets inactivated. Doesn't matter for a homozygous individual, but it does matter for a heterozygous individual. So if you think back to heterozygous individuals when we first started talking about this in pea plants, and when we first looked at Punnett squares, I said there are two ways that you can become heterozygous, right? You can get the dominant from your mother, recessive from your father, or the other way around. But in those cases, in most cases, it doesn't matter. That's why we use the same genotype for both of those possibilities, because it doesn't matter which parent you got the dominant one from and the recessive one. But it does matter for an imprinted gene. And in this case, it's the mother's one that gets turned off. So you have two different kinds of heterozygotes, in essence, when it comes to phenotype. In the left one here on the bottom, the normal allele is the one that this rodent got from its father. It's going to stay on. The small body allele was from the mother, and it gets turned off. So this mouse is going to be normal size. But the other kind of heterozygous is just the opposite. He got the mutant allele small body size from his father. That stays on. The normal size one from the mother gets turned off, and therefore he's a dwarf mouse. It doesn't involve any change to DNA sequence, and that's why it's an epigenetic change. It involves rearrangement of DNA to make it accessible or not. Not rearrangement of the sequence, rearrangement of the whole chromatin structure. And that is Bio 181.
That's it.
So yeah, that's it from me. So let me Before I forget, let me say, even though it's been on the syllabus all term, I have a feeling that not every one of you has read the syllabus. The final is Tuesday, right? But it is at 11 o'clock, not at 11:30. So don't show up at 11:30. It starts at 11, okay? As usual, don't forget Scantrons for that. And also, if you haven't yet opted for the optional retake, but you want to, it has to be today. It's not going to be available. The yellow button on the Hoffman site will disappear tonight. So if you have no idea what I'm talking about, then you haven't lived up to your duty of paying attention to the announcements. And just go to the Hoffman site today and click on the yellow button. See you Tuesday.
See you.